Game on 2FM with Green Farm. Fuel your day with Green Farm's new high-protein cooked chicken breast fillets. 100% natural and packed with flavour.
Thanks to Jenny Green, it's Wednesday the 15th of September and this is Game On. Coming up today, after nearly a year off the race course, Davy Russell is standing by as he aims to make more memories.
And Davy Russell, what a superb performance by Tiger Roll, who has won back-to-back Grand Nationals. The horse is still only nine, we might well see him back here again, but whatever happens, he will be remembered by this generation in the same breath as some of the Aintree greats.
Peter Collins is here to reflect on the Schumacher era as a new documentary on the German great hits Netflix.
100% perfection. To reach 100%. It's my target. I'm just a type of person. I couldn't live with anything lower.
I don't like to talk about my quality very much because I would sound arrogant. And I don't like to talk about my failures because it's your job to find them.
We'll check in with Irish MMA star Liam McCourt ahead of her big Bellator bout in Wembley. Plus, will we see more late drama tonight in the Champions League?
With the victory they were hoping for coming out for that second half. Oh, maybe they will. It's Siam Batu deep into stoppage time. Jordan Siam Batu has sparked pandemonium.
What is Jesse Lingard thinking of?
Now, if you want to get in touch, you can do so by texting us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
GameOn2FM.
Now, welcome along. As I mentioned at the top of the show, Davy Russell is returning to the saddle at Downpatrick on Friday after 11 months on the sidelines with a neck injury. And he joins us now on the line. Davy, you must be mad to get back going again.
Yeah, I'm getting there now. So it's been a bit delayed a couple of times. So it's great to get there.
So Davy, tell us a little bit about what the last 11 months have been like for you, for somebody that obviously loves what he does, loves competing, loves racing, not been able to do that. What was it like?
It wasn't too bad because, you know, I just had to accept that I had a serious injury, and it was all about recovering and it was always about trying to get back, you know, and it wasn't too different, you know. It was a challenge, yeah, but there was always light at the end of the tunnel, you know. It was, you know, once the operation went well and everything, the recovery was going well, I was always, you know, happy that I was going to get there, so it was never too bad that way.
What kind of a patient are you?
I'm not so bad. I was a bit, I found it hard at the start because I couldn't drive and I had to walk everywhere, and then I started cycling and I had a body cast on me and a neck cast, and it was kind of difficult. I couldn't see behind me and things like that. So it was hard for a while now, but once I got, it was a huge relief to get the whole cast and the neck brace off me. But so that was the first couple of weeks or months or however long it was on was tough, all right.
So what did you miss most during that time, Davy, when you weren't doing what you loved?
Just riding, really. Just competing. And probably, I suppose, being a bit selfish, I suppose, is just the winning. The winning. I love winning. That's the one thing I miss, is walking. Not even walking into the prairie. It's even before that. It's even crossing the line. You know, it's that relief. And it doesn't matter where it is or how it happens, but it's just that feeling when you cross the line. It's irreplaceable, really.
So when you were sitting at home watching racing, do you turn into a bit of a fan, or are you sitting there watching it thinking about what you would do in that situation?
A fan. I was keen to watch racing. I didn't watch too much of it now. I probably, you know, I was busy at home. I wanted to keep myself busy. I was trying to do as much exercise as I possibly could because my weight was my biggest issue. So I didn't want to let my weight go up too much. So I was kind of pretty busy most of the time around the farm and stuff. And, you know, five children and, you know, it's kind of, you know, it's a hectic house, you know. So
there's a bit of work in five children, all right, I'd say.
Yeah, well, I have a good health now, to be fair.
So what was the whole recovery process then like, Davy? So, like, you're in and you have an operation, you're in a neck brace. Like, how do you progress from there and how does it feel?
Yeah, I suppose It started when I woke up from the operation, and I had a fantastic surgeon. I was so lucky. Mr. Butler looked after me. So once the words came out of his mouth that everything went fine and he's happy, and kind of, you know, put it in a way that it's nearly stronger now than it was before I had the fall, for, you know, the way they went to, they fused a couple together and they put in a fake vertebrae. So it started then, and to be honest, when I woke from the operation, I wanted to start walking straight away, and I started walking up and down the steps in the hospital, and I wasn't there for that long. I was only there for a day or two afterwards. It was very tough beforehand because I had to go into traction, and they had to straighten a couple of vertebrae. There was a couple of them to the side and dislocated, and I've never felt anything like that. Now, that was quite strange and eerie. But once it was over, I didn't have too much pain, but I had that feeling of rigidness. And so then it was on to the physio, and I'm just blessed with the people that I have around me. I have a fantastic physio in Clonmel, Sean Deegan. So he looked into every way that we could get this going properly, and he was in contact with Mr. Butler, and then Jennifer and the medical team in the turf club. You know, there was a huge team around me, and it just went from there. Was, I suppose, it started with Mr. Butler, and all his staff were fantastic, and then it moved on to my physio and Jennifer and all Sean Deegan's staff as well. So it was just a combined thing, you know.
And like, Davey, at your age now, like 41, I think you are now at this stage, to do 11 months of rehab and recovery, like, that's a huge undertaking. Did you ever think, okay, maybe this is it?
No, not really. Once Mr. Butler was happy, you know, like, I kind of left it. He said he was happy, and he spoke about other patients that he dealt with in sport, probably more severe than my sport in the past, and they played after a very similar break. So it was kind of up for it. Like, you know, I was happy enough to go at it, you know, and, you know, once we were making progress the whole time, it was a help. It was just, I suppose, Cheltenham was a bit of a kick. I got a bit of a pain in my stomach after Cheltenham now, and it was just kind of 50-50 at that stage. And, you know, they made the decision for me, and I just wasn't ready. But, you know, I kind of got over that and moved on from that then. And once I was back flying, and I knew kind of myself in Cheltenham, heading for Cheltenham, I wouldn't have done myself justice now. And so I thought if I had to stay at that level, I would have struggled to have come back. But it just kept on improving with loads of work, and once we got stuck into it and I was getting better, then I was happy, you know. But there's plenty of pain there. Well, not so much pain. Well, yeah, there's pain there at the moment, but it's not pain from my neck. It's just pain from muscles, you know, building muscles that haven't been used in a long time, that were used to being used, you know. So, you know, still working on it, you know.
Mentally, though, like, you must require a huge amount of strength to be able to cope with all of that.
Sure, I don't know. I don't know much about that. I was happy. Just kind of, I put it over my head when it started, and again, it was all down to the surgeon, and his words were very important to me, you know. And then, sure, once these words were came out, I was, you know, the mental side of it was fine. But I suppose if there was a doubt there that the whole thing didn't work out and things didn't go according to plan, then I suppose the mental strain might have been hard. But, you know, to be honest, it was up and going fairly immediate now. You know, I didn't delay at that side, but didn't do much lying down, you know.
Yeah, I suppose you do still have an awful lot going on, as you said, as well at home. And then just in terms of getting back to full fitness, I know you said the muscles are a little bit sore and that's probably going to take a bit of time, but just how are you feeling in general then?
Oh, I'm fine. I feel great. I suppose there's times there that, you know, you get sore and things, and that kind of affects you a little bit. And I suppose my weight now is a big thing. I have to lose a lot of weight, and I probably am not the best to be around when I'm in that kind of a space, and that can be hard, all right, but it can be hard that, you know, on the kids and things, you know, a fella's been grumpy around the place. So, but again, you know, you get help for them things too, and they figure themselves out as well.
Is it harder now as you got older, or is it a case that maybe education has improved over the years since you started out, that you're able to handle the weight a little bit better?
Sure. I'm a bit stubborn in my ways, and I was maybe a little bit before the Tough Club and all them things really came in, and the lads now are probably in a much better position. There's no really excuses for them lads, because it's all there for them. Whereas I got loads of bad habits and I never got out of them. But I did have the good fortune to meet a guy, Dan Davies, once, and he said a couple of simple things to me about my diet, and they made a huge difference to me. So I did take them on board, and they are a huge help. But I still have a lot of bad habits now. I do a lot of sweating, and you know, my diet yo-yos a little bit, but I'm getting much better at it now. I am definitely getting, and I don't have to do as light a weight as I used to, which was a big help. You know, Michael O'Leary told me for years to stop doing light, and I wouldn't listen to him until I lost the job, and then I kind of took it on board. You know, I'm always kind of I always act maybe a little bit late and things, you know.
We saw a little bit earlier today that Gordon Elliott, he's back, as we saw him yesterday at the track, but he had his first winner today since returning. How do you feel about just Gordon being back as well? And I guess you guys are back now at the same time.
Yeah, it's great. Now, look, myself and Gordon work really well together. We have done in the past. And I'm an awful lot better rider for Gordon. For when Gordon is going, I just I'm an awful lot better jockey. So I'm really, really looking forward to getting back in there. Now, I've been there quite a bit, helping out with Sneezy and things, as in just riding out. You know, the last couple of days we've schooled an awful lot of horses. You know, I feel great, and the horses seem to be coming along nice and slowly. I suppose it might take a couple of weeks to get back into the full swing of things, but I'm just really looking forward to getting back to what we were used to, you know.
And David, do you think that Gordon will be able to get back to where he was before?
Yeah, well, he started from, you know, nothing, you know, virtually nothing. He started from absolutely nothing, and he came to a point. He still has quite an awful lot of very, very good owners with him now, and a couple of lovely, you know, a lot of nice horses. So I'm fairly confident of that one now. His ability to train horses is not in question, and he doesn't have to start at the very bottom where he has done from the past. So I'd be quite confident that he can get back to the level where he left off.
And do you think people are going to treat him the same?
I suppose a normal person would treat him the same, and you know, if that's the way, I'll be treating him the same, and I suppose a normal human being that understands life in general will treat him the same. So I wouldn't really understand why you wouldn't.
Ruby said last night that he's paid the price for the crime, he's done his time, and that it's time for everybody to move on. So on Friday, you are going to be back, and you are going to be racing in Downpatrick. What are you going to be on?
A horse called The Greek, and another horse called The Abbey. So two spins, The Greek and The Abbey. Yeah, they're two grand horses. Now, I suppose they're not stable stars, but they're not in that the races are competitive, but they're at their own level, if you know what I mean. So fingers crossed. The Greek is very consistent. He always runs a good race, so he's finished in the first two or three in the last four or five runs. And the Abbey's a little bit different. He's a bit funny, but I seem to get on well with him. I have done in the past anyway, so hopefully now we can get that. I schooled him this morning and jumped really well, and good old form and fit and ready to go. So fingers crossed we can get going and get stuck in and try and repay the owners that have stood with us for so long, you know.
Well, Davey, it's great to see you back. It's great to chat to you. And we all wish you the very best of luck over the coming few months.
Thanks, Marie. It'll be great to speak to you.
Talk to you soon.
Game on 2FM with Green Farm. Healthy dinners made easy with Green Farm's high-protein cooked chicken breast fillets range. Available in selected stores nationwide.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On with me, Marie Crowe. We're going to turn our attention now to the Champions League. There are a couple of games already underway with Borussia Dortmund leading Besiktas 1-0. Jude Bellingham with the goal there. And Sheriff, who a lot of Dundalk fans will be very familiar with, are leading Shakhtar Donetsk 1-0, and they are in Enter and Rails group. Now, I'm delighted to say that I am joined on the line by Fergal Brennan, journalist from Merseyside. Fergal, there's only one place to start, really, and that is with Manchester United and what happened last night. We were here watching it, and they went ahead through Ronaldo, and it seemed like it was all going to go according to script, but it didn't. What did we learn from this Manchester United performance, losing 2-1 to Young Boys?
I think the main thing to take from it in terms of United is that everything Manchester United, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer and particularly Cristiano Ronaldo do this season is going to be under the microscope. Prior to Wan-Bissaka getting sent off before half-time, this was cruise control for United. 1-0 up, probably could have been 2 or maybe even 3 before the break. Wan-Bissaka gets sent off and you just started to see a little bit of self-doubt come into the mindsets of the United players. Obviously, United still kind of on the bounce of Ronaldo coming back in. 2 goals against Newcastle in the Premier League at the weekend. Got himself another one yesterday. But I think they just allowed control to go over to Young Boys. And whilst obviously on paper before the game, this would have been pretty much a box ticked for United. 3 points away from home, getting themselves up and running in the Champions League. If you leave the door open and you leave an opportunity for any side that have qualified for the Champions League group stages, whether they're Young Boys or Real Madrid, time and again they probably will take it, and that's what happened with United. I think it was complacency. Even with 10 men, I think they thought they had enough in the bank to go on and win it, and win it fairly comfortably, and that wasn't the case. A little bit of bad luck in added time, Jesse Lingard making a mistake and Young Boys getting themselves the winner. Arguably maybe a tiny bit harsh on United to actually lose and maybe not just come away with a point. But if you are going to be complacent, if there is going to be so much attention on the players rather than the performance, then there is always the potential that you can just get picked off like this.
How much of that attention, though, should be on Ole Gunnar Solskjaer and his ability to direct his team in these really big games? Because it seems to be a massive stumbling block for him.
It does, and I think this is going to be a running theme this season. You know, we've talked about it quite a few times. I know Alan on a Friday has voiced his opinion on Solskjaer and his ability to be up to the job to manage United. He's going to be under so much scrutiny and so much pressure throughout this season, not just because of Ronaldo coming in, but the big sums spent on Varane and Jadon Sancho to bring them to the club. And there was actually quite a good shot of the bench last night with Ronaldo kind of directing proceedings in the last 10 or 15 minutes after he got subbed off, standing next to Solskjaer, kind of almost pointing over his head at the players and directing them and telling them what to do. I've mentioned it quite a few times, but it continues to be the point that Solskjaer is going to have to balance all of these things with the weight of massive amount of attention on him, because he's been given the money and he's been given the opportunity to bring these players in, and he still hasn't won a trophy. If we're sitting here at the end of the season and he hasn't won a trophy, I think his time is up. But in the interim, he's now got an opportunity to go and do that. But everything he does is going to be scrutinised from now until the end of May.
We're only a few games in, but Jadon Sancho, who you just mentioned there, is somebody that is definitely under the microscope. He just seems to be off the pace a little bit. He's hesitant in possession. He's just not been able to show what he's capable of. Is that down to Solskjaer as well?
I think it's a combination of different factors. He did have a bit of an injury at the back end of last season with Borussia Dortmund. That then carried into Euro 2020 with England. Obviously, he wasn't a regular starter for Gareth Southgate during the summer. He kind of played bits and pieces in certain games. And he's had a bit of a disrupted pre-season. I know, obviously, the move to United got wrapped up during Euro 2020. But there's been a lot of little bits and pieces that have disrupted and not allowed him to have a full 5 or 6 weeks build into that team. And now, obviously, all the attention has come on to Ronaldo. That's one place of the front three or front four that is absolutely sewn up now with him in the team. So I think all of these things are weighing on Jadon Sancho. The injuries that he's had, the lack of a full, complete pre-season is obviously an issue. And the Premier League is incredibly demanding. It's not to do down the Bundesliga. We saw the intensity of Bayern Munich against Barcelona last night. But it is different in certain aspects, particularly physically, the amount of ground that you're going to have to cover, the amount of challenges that you're going to have to take. And he will take a bit of time. He's a quality player. I think a few months' time we'll be having a different conversation about Jadon Sancho. But for the moment, he's still finding his feet and he's finding it hard going.
Just when you said finding his feet there, it seems like Barcelona are really struggling to find their feet in this post-Messi era, losing 3-0 to Bayern. Look, I know they did get hammered by them not so long ago as well, but still, like, speaking of microscopes, they're a team that are going to be under the microscope. Do you think we're going to be having a different conversation about them in a few months? Are they in a lot of trouble?
Potentially, yeah. I think Ronald Koeman's kind of working very hard to demonstrate that everything's okay. Messi's gone, but they've still got a lot of quality here, there and everywhere in the team. But we saw last night when they come up against a big rival, and that will be the case in La Liga as well with Atletico and Real Madrid, they are miles off the pace. It was men against boys stuff last night. Bayern were good without even being excellent. They didn't really need to seem to go up too many gears to just brush off Barcelona. All the way over the pitch, they won individual battles, they were better than them in every challenge, they turned the ball over better, and then crucially Robert Lewandowski getting a couple of massive goals. And you look at the situation with Barcelona, yeah, I think Ronald Koeman could be under big pressure, because last night demonstrated where they are, which is they'll still be competitive within a top four finish in Spain, but they're miles off in the Champions League. And in reality, just being a top four team in Spain is not good enough for Barcelona when you think of their history, particularly in the last 10 or 20 years. And I think unless he's able to somehow pull a bit of a miracle out of the bag, I think we could be talking about him being gone possibly before the end of the season.
What about Chelsea, Fergal? A lot of the conversation in the build-up to this Champions League has been about whether or not they're going to be able to defend their title. We saw them in action against Zenit last night, Lukaku with the goal, almost as expected. Do you think they've shown enough after one game to show that they at least have potential to defend that title?
Yeah, I definitely think they're going to be in the mix. I think they'll be right in the mix for the Premier League title as well. I think I mentioned it before, that the interesting thing with Chelsea this season is that Thomas Tuchel is coming into a different environment. Last season when he came in, with half of the season already gone, kind of a little bit of negativity around Frank Lampard and his eventual exit, it was almost a little bit of a free hit. I don't want to undersell what he did. Mm-hmm. He went on and won the Champions League, but he came into the club not as much pressure to go on and win things because of the fact that he didn't have an entire season behind him. He's come in, he won the Champions League, he got all the players on side, he got some real positivity back around the club. He's now had a full summer to prepare them. Obviously, he's brought Lukaku in for massive amounts of money. It's a different set of pressure now being levelled at him, and we'll see how he reacts. But based on the early signs in the Premier League and in the Champions League, he doesn't look too feeling the pressure, and the players, and in particular Lukaku, definitely don't. So I fully expect them to be right in there for both competitions.
We are being treated to some real heavyweight clashes in these early rounds, and it's brilliant. And one that will be on a little bit later is Liverpool and AC Milan. What's the feeling around where you are, Fergal?
I think Jurgen Klopp nailed it in his press conference earlier today, where he said this is a proper Champions League group. Atletico Madrid and Porto in the other game, and then AC Milan tonight, as you mentioned. We talk about games between these two clubs. It's probably the most famous night in the history of Liverpool, even by their high standards. Istanbul, May 25th in 2005. But when you actually look at the two teams in the last 10 years, I think Klopp has been a little bit kind. AC Milan have been way out of the picture. They haven't been in the Champions League since 2013-14, whereas Liverpool have been in two finals in the last four seasons. So whilst Jurgen Klopp will kind of look to play down that, and he was very positive about AC Milan in his press conference, Liverpool will and should expect to win this game. No Roberto Firmino, he's still struggling with an injury, and obviously Harvey Elliott's nasty injury that he picked up at the weekend means he won't play. But Liverpool have looked good so far this season. There hasn't been the excitement of a big amount of new transfers coming in, only Konate being the big name that's arrived at Anfield. But Klopp will be really pleased with the progress. I know a lot of fans that I speak to in Liverpool are really happy with the direction they're moving in at the start of the season. And you look at this, and yes, it's got a huge amount of history behind it because Liverpool and Milan are so successful in the competition. But given where Liverpool are at the minute, I think it should be fairly straightforward for them to kick off tonight with a win.
Okay, well, thank you so much, as always, Fergal Brennan. Enjoy that game. There are some absolutely cracking ties tonight. We'll see Manchester City in action against RB Leipzig. Enter are playing Real, and as Fergal mentioned, Atletico Madrid and FC Porto are also going. It's also going ahead at 8 o'clock. Plus, we're going to see PSG. There'll be a lot of people wondering what that team news is going to be.
Game on 2FM. With Green Firm. Fuel your day with Green Firm's high protein cooked chicken breast fillet. 100% natural and packed with flavour.
Game on 2FM.
The 100% perfection. I couldn't live with anything lower.
He wanted to do something that, you know, hadn't been done by Prost, hadn't been done by Senna, hadn't been done by any of the drivers in recent history.
So I kind of love it, yeah.
I got such a strong impression of how hard Michael was willing to work. And that transformed the team.
And what Schumacher achieved was absolutely incredible.
You're looking good.
Now, that was a clip from a new Netflix documentary on the life of Michael Schumacher, which landed on Netflix today, featuring rare interviews and previously unreleased archive footage of the seven-time world champion. And to discuss it with us is former Formula One presenter, RTE's Peter Collins. Peter, you're so very welcome. That must have really brought you down memory lane.
It certainly did, Marie. I watched it first thing this morning, and yeah, it did bring me down memory lane, because from 95 right through to 2004, RTE carried every single round of the championship, and we were lucky enough to attend all those magnificent races. And of course, that period was also the period which saw Michael Schumacher absolutely dominate the sport. And yeah, there were many, many familiar faces that I was looking at in that documentary, and many, many great moments came back to me as well. But I think my overall feeling, having watched it, was a feeling of real sadness, really, because the story is so devastating for Michael Schumacher and for his family. And there were lots of admirable interviews in it, particularly his family, you know, his wife Corinne and his son Michael in particular, his son Mick. He came across so well, and you can just sense, you know, how much he misses having his father around, even though he is around. But obviously communication, whatever level it's at, is very, very limited. And obviously Mick is now in Formula One, and he would love to be able to talk to his dad and get probably some much needed advice in what is a very difficult and competitive sport. But yeah, overall, it was very sad viewing, but an excellent documentary.
Yeah, there was so much in it, and it just took us right from the very beginning. And I thought that was lovely to be able to see all that footage of him when he was just a kid, and also to be able to get that insight into the competitor that was in him from a very young age. It's just brilliant to have all of that.
Well, I think what was wonderful in it was for people who weren't completely versed in Michael Schumacher's story, was to realise that he came from very little. I wouldn't say he came from nothing, because anybody who owns motor racing at any level has something to start off with. But his equipment wasn't great, as we saw, you know, that he was racing with an inferior car, with an inferior tyres, which are very significant in karting, as everybody knows. And so he had to work his way up the tough way, you know. And but he was lucky that he was spotted by Willy Weber, his eventual manager, who brought him into motor racing properly and gave him some support, gave him some money. And of course, his dad, Ralph, who worked with him right along the way as well, was very supportive in the early years. But Willy Weber really was the key to Michael getting his break in Formula One. And of course, when we talk about his break, it is significant that he got it in the Irish team. And we were all, I remember anybody who was into motorsport at the time, first of all, couldn't believe that Eddie Jordan had finally gotten his team onto a Formula One grid. It was an extraordinary achievement, and probably wasn't that well documented in Ireland at that particular point. I mean, 1991, people weren't paying that much attention. It wasn't live on RTE. There were highlights on the BBC, there were the odd live races, but for anybody of an interest to see this car, which just coincidentally, because of the 7-Up sponsorship, was green, was even more spectacular. And it did extraordinarily well, that car, the Jordan 191, in that first year. But I think it was Bertrand Gachot who was driving for Jordan at the time, and he got into into a little bit of trouble in London on a night out, and he ended up being arrested. And it's a long and intricate story, which we don't have the time to get into here.
Doesn't sound like a story that would be suitable for radio either.
Well, possibly not, but what transpired was that it opened up the seat for the Belgian Grand Prix in the Jordan team, and Willie Weber gave Eddie Jordan a ring and said, look, any chance you'll give Michael Schumacher a run in the car? And Eddie said, Michael who? You know, well, obviously he wasn't that well known, even though he had driven in German touring car and various junior formulae. But Willy Weber, he informed Eddie of his achievements to date. And I think he also informed Eddie that there'd be a little bit of cash accompanying the drive, which was all important to the team. I mean, money was king at that point, as it is now in Formula One. And then it came to pass that Michael made his debut in the Jordan. I think he qualified at seventh, which was an extraordinary achievement to put that car. It was a brilliant car, but it was powered by a Ford customer Cosworth engine, and to get it to seventh on the grid at Spa-Francorchamps, which is a hugely fast circuit as we've seen recently, and straight away people knew this is a star in the making, and you could see that in the documentary how well he did in that first Grand Prix.
Yeah, and it was great, like you said, that 7-Up image, the green suits and everything. It was lovely to see it. And at the time, Peter, when you were covering it, like, you know, we did have Irish interest, which was, it was obviously a huge deal. Like, what was it like to be, you were part of it?
Yeah. Well, it was every bit as spectacular as it looks on TV, and it's so well covered now, you know, with not just with the live Formula One coverage, but also with the stuff that we see on Netflix as well. You know, it was an extraordinary environment in many ways, because when we arrived in the F1 paddock, I mean, Schumacher was at that stage just beginning to really, really establish himself as a world beater, you know, but we had Eddie Jordan and his Jordan team. And then, of course, Eddie Irvine arrived in as well. And he brought a lot of colour and a lot of character. I mean, many people say, and it's probably true, he was the ideal teammate, really, for Michael Schumacher when he moved to Ferrari. When he moved to Ferrari, Eddie also arrived at the same time. And like many other drivers, they knew they were there to worship at the altar of Michael Schumacher because he was the best. He dictated things in the team. The car was designed around Michael's preferences. So for Eddie Irvine, it was a tricky task. But I have to say, of all the drivers that went up against Michael Schumacher, Eddie probably achieved more than anybody else, probably because Eddie had a very relaxed attitude compared to most other drivers in Formula One in and around that time. He wasn't intimidated by Michael Schumacher because he knew Michael was the best in the world at that point. He knew that he wasn't going to beat him for the world championship unless something extraordinary happened. And Eddie, many people say, was the last of the so-called playboy Formula One drivers. You know, he was a great racer, in fairness to him. He was very competitive. But he also enjoyed the Formula One lifestyle. He lived that. And in many ways, he was, I suppose, at the other end of the spectrum to Michael Schumacher in terms of approach. I mean, Michael's approach was 100% dedication. Very little, if anything, was left to chance. You know, they tested and tested and tested, something they can't do now to the same extent because of the restrictions on the teams. But Eddie was, in contrast to that, he enjoyed, you know, his nights out, and he enjoyed a party. And but he raced hard. And he competed hard, but he knew he was never going to live with Michael Schumacher's speed.
We could see that, all right, from the doc, how hard that Schumacher worked, how late he used to stay there, how much dedication he put into even things like his diet. Another thing we saw as well is that competitive edge, and it was interesting to see that and to also have it alongside the stories of how much of a family man he was, how dedicated he was, how he had that softer side as well. And we did get a little bit of an insight into that. And, you know, I even loved the bits of him, the video, the clips of him singing at the parties, throwing his friends into the pool, like just his interaction with his children and his wife as well.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we saw very little of the Michael Schumacher, the family man, away from the track. But I do remember seeing Michael Schumacher, the party man, at the end of one particular season. It was at the end of the season at the Japanese Grand Prix in Suzuka. And everybody who was involved in the sport at the time used to gather at the Suzuka circuit at a place called the Log Cabin, which was essentially a series of log cabins where they enjoyed karaoke, as they do in Japan. It's one of the national pastimes. I have to say, I never enjoyed it that much. But we were looking for one of the karaoke cabins to see could we get in for a sing-song somewhere, if myself and a few of the other people who were travelling with us from Ireland. And we opened one of the doors, and a cacophony of absolute noise was pouring out. And in the middle of it was Michael Schumacher singing very, very badly out of tune and holding a bottle of something. It definitely wasn't water, but it was the end of the season and he was able to let his hair down. But he was only able to let his hair down in the company of people he was comfortable with.
Yeah, because he was very private and he liked to keep his private life put away in a box. So how did that then affect his relationship with the media, with the press?
Well, he didn't like the press or the media for a number of reasons. First of all, he was essentially a very shy guy. But when you become probably the best known sportsman on the planet, there's very little room for shyness. But he coveted his time very well and only gave to the media at Formula One races when he was, we say, over the Formula One weekends. There was very little about Michael Schumacher you could access prior to that or even after a race weekend. But I do remember a significant interview for RTE, which was at the 1996 Pacific Grand Prix in Aida. And it was the evening before he was due to, well, probably win his second world championship. And a press conference was arranged. It was the only press conference he was giving. And our astute producer at the time, Michael O'Carroll, said to me, he said, "You get there early, right? You get there early. I don't want you hanging around the paddock talking nonsense with people. Get there early. Get there before everybody else." So I got there before everybody else, and there was seats laid out in the normal press conference fashion. There were areas for photographers. So in attendance, probably around 300 members of the world's media, all focusing on Michael Schumacher. But I had luckily got the seat directly in front of where he was going to sit. So to cut a long story short, Michael arrived. He looked at me. I said, "Michael, it's for Irish television." He just nodded, didn't say anything. And I started the interview. And a very straightforward question. And he gave me a magnificent, expansive answer. And I thought, this is gold. This is gold. And I'm getting it first, you know. And then asked him a second question. And next thing, I felt a tap on my shoulder. And I turned around and our cameraman said, "Sorry, my battery's after going."
Oh, no.
And everybody, there was a gasp in the room. And I turned around and Michael Schumacher was glaring at me. And he said, "You call this preparation?" And I said,
"Peter."
Yes. Thankfully, I wasn't in charge of the batteries. But I looked at him. I said, "Michael," I said, "I'm extremely sorry." I said, "We hire a camera from RTL Germany, you know." I said, in other words, implying that this would never happen in an RTE camera. So he looked at me and he sort of smirked and he just put his finger in the air and he drew down. He said, "Okay, one all."
Oh, nice.
And I said, "Could we begin the interview again?" He said, "Yes." And again, he gave me, I mean, I could only do about four questions because the world and his wife wanted to talk to Michael Schumacher that night. But we got our interview and he was very cooperative. He was very professional in that situation. And we also had a chance to interview him. He came to visit Ireland, I think in 2000 or 2001. And we had a sit-down interview with him, which was a far more personal interview back in 2001. And again, he was extremely cooperative, extremely polite. And that's the way he conducted himself in public when he was on, as it were, on duty. But then when he was finished his duties in relation to his Formula One career, he just wanted away from media, away from press.
And there was a few controversial incidents throughout his career as well, Peter. And I think when you see them in the documentary kind of laid out one after the other, like, it does show that he is a win-at-all-costs kind of guy, and he's very reluctant to admit that he has made a mistake or that he's wrong. Did that damage any of his relationships with his competitors, or were they always just respectful of the competitor that he was?
Well, it probably did. I mean, the first incident that I recalled was the Australian Grand Prix in Adelaide in, I think it was 94. And Schumacher had a problem. He had a coming together with Damon Hill, and it was fairly obvious to most observers that Schumacher had created the incident, because if neither of them finished, it would guarantee Michael the world championship. But Damon kept going for about another half a lap, but it was fairly obvious that Damon had got some suspension damage on his Williams, as we saw in the documentary, and therefore he had to pull out, and that clinched Michael's first championship. Many people felt the manoeuvre on Michael's part to try and drive Damon off the circuit. Now, it wasn't a high-speed incident. It was a very slow-speed incident. That really showed that this guy will try and win at all costs. And I think it was the following season in Jerez in Spain where he did drive into the side of Jacques Villeneuve's car. Again, it was Williams. And that was shown in the documentary as well. But there was another famous incident in 2006 where he was on for pole position at the Grand Prix in Monaco, and he came around on his final lap and tried to fake that he was losing control of the car and sort of parked it into the barrier to block the circuit. So I think it was Fernando Alonso, who was on a flying lap for Renault, wouldn't get to complete his lap and therefore wouldn't be able to take pole position from him. Now, he was penalised for that, and I think he was bumped from pole position. But yeah, he proved on many occasions that when he got behind the wheel of the car, that it was a win at all costs. But you find that many of the great world champions of the past, including Ayrton Senna, would have been of that mentality as well. And it's a dangerous sport, so sometimes that didn't go down with the authorities, and it didn't go down well with some of his fellow competitors, yeah.
And Peter, look, I guess, as you said, he is a global star, and yeah, Everybody's so fascinated by him and also very curious as to how he is now. We didn't really get much information on that, but when you consider everything that we saw in the documentary and you outlined there that he was always a private person, that they probably had a duty to protect him as well and to keep whatever is going on with him now private.
Yeah, and you have to respect that. I mean, the people I've spoken to who are still around the Formula One paddock, everybody has an idea, but nobody has ever been told for certain as to what Michael's condition is. And only very close friends, such as Ross Brawn and Jean Todt, have been to see him, and they know. But again, they've kept their counsel on it, and you just have to respect that. But you have to imagine that, sadly, the situation cannot be great for Michael. But what the family have done over the years supporting him, and I know they've spent many, many millions and millions and millions, you know, to keep him as comfortable as possible, and possibly in the hope that one day there'll be some sort of light at the end of what is apparently a very dark tunnel for Michael.
Yeah, well, that documentary is on Netflix now and it is well worth checking out. I do agree with you though, Peter, that it is all kind of tinged with sadness because everybody knows the situation now. But thank you very much for coming in.
Not at all. Just before I go, people often say to me now, are there any Irish people left in Formula 1 these days?
And are they?
Yes, the thing is, there are, you know, and there are mechanics, there are engineers, there are designers sprinkled around the paddock, you know, and there's also a very good Irish Formula 1 website, which is called Straight to the Grid, and some of that information can be garnered through that website as well. So if people want to make an Irish connection with Formula 1 these days, it is possible. So check out Straight to the Grid.
Right, we will check that out. And thank you very much for bringing us on a trip down memory lane.
Thanks, Marie.
With Green Fern, have your dinner ready in a flash with Green Fern's high protein cooked chicken breast fillet, available in selected stores nationwide.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On. So Dortmund have doubled their lead against Besiktas with Haaland getting that second goal, and Sheriff are still leading Shakhtar Donetsk 1-0 around 48 minutes gone in both games. Liverpool team news is out as well. No Virgil van Dijk in the starting 11. He is on the bench though, so hopefully it doesn't mean that he's injured or anything, and Origi is in instead of Mane. Now I am going to turn my attention to Liam McCourt, who is taking on American Jessica Borga in the co-feature bout of the first MMA event with fans back in the SSC Arena in Wembley on October 1st. And she is with me now on the line. Leah, exciting times. How have your preparations been going?
Yeah, so exciting. Preparations are good, feeling strong, and really excited to be back in front of fans in 2 weeks.
Yeah, it is. It's been different for everybody, obviously, over the last while. And just in terms of your career and how everything has been going, Leah, was it affected much by COVID? I know that you live in Belfast, but you did spend a lot of time training in Dublin.
Yeah, so like obviously, I actually fought in a 3 Arena, and I headlined that in February 2020, and it was literally like the next week or two that everyone went into lockdown. So it pretty much went from like me and my life being so intense and busy to just like a standstill. I actually had to go get shoulder surgery in the July of that year, and that was a bit held me back, and I actually got COVID myself. So I had a bit of a year of injuries and illnesses, and I was back in the cage in May, and now I'm excited to be back in fighting in London. I was actually meant to fight in London last May, but it was cancelled because of COVID. So it's great to be back, and I'm so excited to be in front of it, you know, we're back in Europe fighting.
Yeah, and I think fans make all the difference, really. It's so hard to kind of replicate that same energy when you don't have those people cheering you on. And like, just in terms of your career, you don't lose fights anyway, Leah.
No, I try not to. I know I want to. I've got a good win streak, and I just keep building on it. I'm excited to go out, and I don't have as many injuries as I did going to my last fight. So I really hope I'll put on a good performance for the crowd and get a great win in front of everyone.
You've got a brilliant backstory as well, yeah. And I'd read about you a couple of years ago. It was probably actually just before that very first lockdown when you did win that fight. And one thing that stuck out to me with your story, so you are a mum of an 11-year-old and you just are so dedicated to what you're trying to achieve. And as I mentioned a little bit earlier, living in Belfast, travelling down to train in the SBG Charleston gym, and just all the time that you are giving, there must be a huge amount of sacrifices made along the way as well.
Yeah, too much sacrifice and dedication to be able to achieve these things, and you know, it's paid off, and all the hours and doing all the things that other people don't do is being able to give me, you know, great experiences and rewards and be able to like open doors and have opportunities. So it's, and look where I am now. Do you know, I'm able to co-main event in Wembley. It's like a dream come true. You know, it's definitely. Looking back, it's quite emotional, like all the hard things that I've had to go through, but to get here, it's, you know, everything's been worth it.
And how does your daughter feel about you headlining a huge fight? And look, I've seen the clips and the posters and all the social media and stuff. It must be pretty cool for her.
Yeah, she honestly isn't fazed, because if you think about it, like all her life she's just used to media and fight camps and fighting, and that's just what her mum does. So she's just takes in her stride.
Yeah, she probably doesn't think that it's as big a deal maybe as somebody from the outside looking in. And just,
yeah.
Just in terms of being a female in your sport, what's the environment like, and just what's the progression of the sport like for women?
Yeah, you know, I see more females coming through, especially in Ireland. I know there was a load of Irish girls over at the IMAF tournament, I think it was last week, and loads of them did amazing, and it's great to see them coming up and progressing, and hopefully they turn pro as well. So I love seeing like more girls, because you know, it is a tough sport, it's a tough environment to train in, and I just love seeing more girls. Even myself, I coach women, they just want to train, they don't want, you don't have to fight to be MMA, you can go and learn self-defense, learn martial arts. I just love seeing women being active and doing that.
And what about the health benefits of being a professional MMA artist? It must be like just having that fitness and strength at the level that you have, Leah.
Yeah, you need it when you're locked in a cage and someone's trying to you know, take that win. You need every bit of fitness and kind of strength that you can get, and that's why obviously I train so hard and dedicate myself so much, because I want to come out on top, and you need to put in hundreds of thousands of hours to get to that place, and then nobody really understands that. You know, they all see the wins and everything, but there's just so much dedication and sacrifice and hard times going to, you know, getting these big opportunities.
So tell me a little bit then about that training regime, that fitness regime that you have. How relentless is it?
Yeah, and you know, we kind of have to look after our own schedules and come up with the correct formula. Obviously, MMA is so diverse. There's so many different martial arts involved, and you really have to work on your weaknesses and your strengths and just make sure you've got that right, you know, amount of time in each area leading up to a fight. And sometimes you get it wrong, sometimes you get it right. But I think, you know, the hours and hours of the mat, they don't lie. And whenever you get in there, you can show how much you put yourself in bad positions, how much you've trained in the gym and done rounds and rounds with the guys, you know, and it is definitely tough.
It feels like it's one of those sports that you just never stop learning in it.
Yeah, exactly. You never do. Like, I go into the gym and just still feel like I don't know anything. I just, I don't know why I still feel like this. I just, like, sometimes I think it's, you know, you've got these moments like, oh, how am I going to get into this cage and fight? Like, what am I going to do? And then you have to just kind of center yourself and be like, I know you do this every day. You're a professional fighter. Like, you know how to fight. You can do this.
So you're fighting Jessica Borga. She's an American. What do you know about her?
I know she's stylistically quite similar to me. She likes to grapple. She likes to put it against the cage and take it to the ground. So it'll be an interesting matchup. You know, one mistake and you're on the floor and getting your face smashed in a bad position. So I just need to be switched on and sharp from the moment I go in. I don't think she'll have felt strength like mine, and I know in the clinch that I will be have the advantage because that's where, you know, I like to be. I don't think she'll have felt strength like me, and you know, those difficult positions. So it's going to be an interesting fight.
And how confident are you, Leah?
Always confident. Always know I'm going to win.
That mentality, though, like, you know, any MMA fighter that I have encountered over the last number of years, that confidence, is that innate or is it something that you need to work on?
I think when you put the R's in, you just believe in yourself and believe, and I've overcome so much. I just believe in my resilience and my killer instinct when I get in the cage. You know, everybody's different, and I have doubts and nerves and those voices in your head like anybody does, but it's that just, you know, making sure you listen to the voice of telling you, know, you're going to win, you're going to do this. It's most important.
Well, Leah, we wish you the very, very best of luck. Just tell us, just before we finish up, when you're fighting and what card is it on, and you know, can people watch you?
Yeah, it's on Bellator London on the 1st of October, live from SSC Wembley. It's BBC iPlayer in the UK. I think it's Virgin Media Sports in the Southern Ireland as well.
Okay, well, Leah, best of luck with that. We look forward to tuning in and also following your career. We'll talk to you hopefully again very, very soon. That is all that we have time for. We will be back tomorrow with another very, very busy show. Tara Kumar is up next.